You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
And I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. Throughout the 2016 campaign, Donald Trump railed against the nuclear deal reached with Iran. Yet this past April, the Trump administration certified that Iran is complying with the agreement. Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council, examines the history and strategy behind the historic agreement of 2015 in his latest book, Losing an Enemy: Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. It's published by Yale University Press. And Trita, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, so before we can even begin to talk about your book, you've got to go to the beginning and the reason for the book, and that is the official name is the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
Yeah.
So not to get way down in the weeds, because we've got a lot of time, but not that much time. What are the key points people need to understand of what we all shorthand call the Iran nuclear deal?
Sure. The most important thing to realize is that this deal achieved two major objectives for the United States, two major wins. It took two horrific outcomes off the table. The horrific outcome of the Iranians being able to build a nuclear weapon, which would be significantly destabilizing for the world. And it also took off the table the option, the also equally horrific option, of the United States going to war with Iran, particularly after Iraq and Afghanistan. A war with Iran would be truly devastating for everyone involved. In one move, this international crisis that had been going on for about 16 years was resolved peacefully without a single fire being shot.
Wow. And so then why, again, for people who don't know, it wasn't just the United States and Iran who were negotiating this. This was a multi-prong negotiation. Who were the countries involved, and what were their interests in all of this?
And I'm glad you asked that, because people tend to think that because Trump says that he's going to walk out of the deal, that it's just a deal between the United States and Iran. This is actually a deal between the P5 plus one, which are the permanent members of the UN Security Council. So that's France, the United Kingdom, Germany, Russia, China, and then the plus one is Germany. All of these countries who have significant disagreements, particularly Russia and China with the United States, on many other issues, on this issue, came together. And in fact, as I document in the book, the Russians were tremendously helpful, despite the fact that the Ukraine crisis was happening in the midst of all of this, because they all agreed this issue needed to be resolved, and it needed to be resolved peacefully, and they succeeded.
Now, what about Japan or India or Brazil?
So in earlier iterations, before this round of negotiations actually started and succeeded, several other countries had tried. Turkey and Brazil at one point actually did manage to get the Iranians to agree to a proposal that originally was an American proposal. But by the time they got Iran to say yes, President Obama was no longer ready because of domestic political circumstances in the U.S. Japan had tried to quietly in the background, but in a rather timid way, also find resolutions. But there's one country who is not included in the P5 plus one, but actually played an absolutely instrumental role in getting this done. And very little has been said about it. And that's the country of Oman, a very, very small country on the Arabian Peninsula. Most people have never heard of it. But very quietly in the background, they have done quite a lot of things. And it's not just this thing. They also played an instrumental role in bringing down the apartheid regime and getting a negotiated settlement between de Klerk and Mandela. In fact, it was the same individuals.
Okay, so you can't just drop that drop that little nugget of news about this small country that, you're right, most people have never heard of on the Arabian Peninsula. But what is it about Oman, this tiny country, that is able to wield such influence in key geopolitical issues?
More than anything else, I think it is because they're simply respected. Now, the Omanis played an instrumental role in getting the three American hikers that were wrongfully imprisoned in Iran a couple of years ago out. They did that by working closely with then-Senate Foreign Relations Chair John Kerry. By succeeding in getting the Americans out, and as you know, they flew back to Oman on the Sultan's private jet. And the Omanis also paid the the money to get them released. They proved that they actually had the capacity to get the Iranians to deliver. They knew how to maneuver the very complex Iranian political system. Very few countries know how to do that. And Kerry, who's always been a very strong proponent of diplomacy, was then arguing and pushing the White House to start a secret negotiation in Oman, parallel to the P5+1 talks. And the first meeting was held in July 2012. The background to this is important because at the time, the U.S. approach was almost essentially just focusing on sanctions and pressuring the Iranians. And by God, the sanctions were hurting the Iranians. The Iranian currency dropped 50%. Their GDP contracted 25%. But the Iranians were hurting, but they weren't breaking. And in fact, they were responding in kind. As much sanctions were imposed, the Iranians aggressively expanded their nuclear program. What's so funny about that first meeting is that the U.S. side came there to kind of see, is this an authoritative channel? Does this Iranian supreme leader back this channel? And secondly, to see how close are the Iranians to capitulating? The Iranians came not to capitulate, but to see how close is the United States to capitulating. So as a result, you can imagine it was not a successful meeting. But a second meeting was held and some critical breakthroughs, and I can go into the details if you want on that, were had in those secret negotiations that actually enabled the rest of the negotiations that the Russians and the Chinese and everyone else was doing.
Well, see, that anticipates the question I was going to ask and didn't realize we were going to actually go down this route, which was how did diplomacy triumph under President Obama? And did his change in course, how did that compare to the predecessors? Because Iran was not something that just sort of appeared on the radar screen under President Obama. This has been an ongoing challenge for the West.
Absolutely. And the different approach could not have been any starker. The Bush administration actually opposed the very idea of diplomacy. The Bush administration believed, they had held a strong ideological view, that the United States is the ultimate source of legitimacy in the international system. And if there are countries that we have deemed to be rogue nations, we should not talk to them, because by talking to them, we legitimize them. Our awesome legitimacy rubs off on them.
That's right. President Bush dubbed Iran was part of the quote-unquote axis of evil.
So the Bush administration thought that by just sanctioning, threatening war, sabotage, cyber warfare, they could stop this program. And it was an utter failure. The Iranians had roughly 150 centrifuges. Those are the machines that you use to enrich uranium. In 2003, by the time Bush left office, Iran had more than 8,000 centrifuges. It had roughly 1,500 kilos of low-enriched uranium, which is enough to build a bomb. That's the track record of not pursuing diplomacy. And that's the track record we should keep in mind today, mindful of what is happening with North Korea.
Oh, we're going to get to North Korea because I want to know if there are any lessons to be learned from Iran to how the United States and the Trump administration should deal with North Korea. But sticking with President Obama's approach to Iran and to the deal. As you were speaking, I remembered it was during the UN General Assembly, remind me of the year, when for the first time since the hostage crisis in the 70s, an American president and a leader from Iran met. And I'm using the word met in the broadest possible sense. Can you talk about that? And how and what role that played in the eventual deal?
So that's in September 2013. What you had was in March of 2013, the major breakthrough in the secret negotiations. And then everyone got lucky because Rouhani won the elections. And Rouhani had been the previous chief nuclear negotiator back in the early 2000s, before Ahmadinejad came to power. His nickname in Iran was the Sheikh of Diplomacy. He's someone who actually takes pride in actually being able to negotiate and has the courage to say yes. And this is an important point. It's always easier in political system to say no than to say yes. So once Rouhani came in, the negotiations just went to a different level. Everything moved faster. To give you an example, in the previous rounds, when Ahmadinejad was president, the Iranians insisted that when a negotiation was held, all of the other delegations, the Chinese, the Russians, etc., had to come into the room first and get seated. Once everyone was seated, the Iranians would walk in. Then once the talks were over, and usually it was just a competition of different speeches, no real negotiations. No one was allowed to stand up until every Iranian had left the room. That was because they were trying to make sure that there were absolutely no side chit-chats, that there would actually be no other communications taking place except those official ones. As you can imagine, that's not how diplomacy works. That's impossible. You need to build a rapport. What they did in Oman is that they went for long walks. They divided themselves up into different groups. They started to get to know each other. That's critical in order to actually be able to negotiate. So once Rouhani comes in, everything changes and things move in the right direction. And Obama really wanted to see if he could get that handshake. And originally, it seemed as if it was about to happen, but then the Iranians, they kind of got cold feet and they had to cancel last minute. But as Rouhani was on his way to the airport to leave the United States, he placed a phone call to President Obama. And even though they didn't meet, they didn't shake hands, they actually had a 15-minute conversation, which also went a long way in showing that both sides were willing to put political capital into making sure that this process would be successful.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopez and speaking with Trita Parsi about his new book, Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Thank you for that correction, because it was such a momentous event. The fact that the two leaders spoke,
actually in the same room. They were. Obama sat in when Rouhani gave his speech and vice versa, but they didn't shake hands at the moment.
Yeah. Right. But what I was going to say is that it was such a momentous event that I thought it was a meeting. But yes, it was a phone call. Mm. And there was also like an exchange of tweets as well. Welcome to the 21st century, where leaders speak to each other via Twitter. But it was an amazing and pivotal moment for the U.S. and Iranian relationship. But that wasn't the... Things didn't smooth over and things didn't run smoothly after that, did they?
No, it was tough. I mean, these were 20 months of really excruciating negotiations. I mean, I interviewed almost every one of the negotiators on all sides. I sat down with the Iranian foreign minister numerous times. Interviews with Kerry, with Wendy Sherman, all of these people. And I got to tell you, these people made some significant sacrifices. They were away from their families for a very long time. I'm not going to mention any names, but some of them were close to divorces, etc. They really put some stuff into making this happen for the country and for the world as a whole. And to give you an example, in one of the rounds of the negotiations, the U.S. and Iran actually had worked quietly in the background. They kind of got a deal. They went to the rest of the P5+1, thought that they would just get a sign-off from everyone. But the French objected. They were insulted that they were not brought into the process earlier, even though they made some question marks about some substance issues. The real issue was that how dare you make a deal without France? So around, I think it was 2 a.m. in the morning, the Russian foreign minister comes down to the lobby of the hotel where the negotiations were taking place, where all the journalists are sitting. His security personnel essentially evacuates most of the lobby, and he goes straight into the bar at the restaurant and orders a full bottle of vodka. Rest assured, if Donald Trump thinks that these countries are going to agree to negotiate this deal again, he's going to be in for a very big surprise. No one's going to agree to do that.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Trita Parsi, founder and president of the National Iranian American Council, about his book, Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. We'll be right back after a break. Jonathan Capehart sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Trita Parsi about his new book, Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy, and it's all about the Iran nuclear deal. You open the book with a description of the confrontation between a U.S. naval vessel and Iranian forces just before then-President Obama was to deliver his State of the Union address. Talk about what happened and how that event factored into the Iran nuclear deal at that point.
So this is the same day as the State of the Union, a couple of hours before. And it's about 4 or 5 days before the Iran deal was officially going to be implemented. The Iranians had already done a lot of their stuff. But around 20th of January, the U.S. was supposed to take its first steps by lifting some sanctions. And then you had 10 U.S. Sailors who were supposed to go on a routine mission, take their boat, I believe it was from Kuwait to Bahrain, And for a series of innocent mistakes, they got lost. And they had to cannibalize one of their boats because the equipment got broke. They knew they were lost. They just didn't know where.
Right. And they didn't know how far.
And they didn't know how far. And then suddenly some Iranian IRGC vessels show up. And then they realize, oh, shoot, we're in Iranian waters. That's not good news. They arrest him and they take him in. And the Iranian foreign minister was informed about this about 4 hours later. And he was already scheduled to have a call with John Kerry about 45 minutes after he had received the news because of the implementation of the nuclear deal. Immediately, they connect with each other, and Kerry asked Arif, did he hear about it? And he was like, well, if you hadn't called me, I would have called you. And within an hour and a half, they had a deal. They had 5 to 6 conversations that evening. Within an hour and a half, by the second phone call, they had a deal on how to resolve this. The reason why it took another 16 hours to get them released was because it was night in Iran. But this is really astonishing. A couple of years earlier, a similar thing had happened with some British sailors. And they had been taken. Ahmadinejad was president. And the Iranians kept them for 2 weeks. And the Brits had to beg and plea to get them out. John Kerry got them out in an hour and a half. For a very simple reason. By that time, the United States and Iran had actually not only started to become on talking terms, a degree of trust and confidence had been developed between Kerry and Zarif. And as a result, both of them could work their systems and make sure that this innocent incident would not stand in the way of not only the nuclear deal that was going to go into effect just a couple of days later, but also a very sensitive negotiation about a prisoner swap that got several Iranian Americans released out of Iranian jails, including Jason Rezaian, a Washington Post.
Yes, my fellow Washington Post colleague.
Exactly, and my friend Jason, as well as several Iranians who were in prison in the United States. So a tremendous amount was at stake. And what this showed is this is what diplomacy can do. In the absence of that relationship, in the absence of all of those hours they had spent together and gotten to know each other and started to trust and understand each other, this crisis would have led to something much bigger, perhaps another Iranian hostage crisis. Instead, now, most Americans don't even know it happened.
Yeah, there's a lot of things in there that you talked about that folks should pay attention to. One, cooler heads prevailed on the Iranian side, on the American side, between the two foreign ministers and the Secretary of State. The actual captain of the boat, of the disabled boat. You have a quote in there of him saying, you know, I'm not going to, basically, I'm paraphrasing here, I'm not going to start a war over a bleeping, you know, nonsense issue, a bleeping nonsense issue. The key thing here was trust. In diplomacy, that is everything. You don't have to like the other person across the table from you. You don't have to like their politics or their country. But if you don't have trust, you can't get anything done.
You can't get anything done. And in fact, in the case of the U.S. and Iran, it wasn't even that much trust that was established.
Right.
It was a minimum amount so that they could deal with each other. But the deal itself is not based on the trust between the two sides. It's based on the trust in the mechanisms of the deal that ensures that the other side cannot cheat. We have the most intrusive inspections regime in Iran right now. We trust that regime, and we should trust that. And that's what's so problematic that Donald Trump right now wants to kill the deal, despite the fact that IAEA is saying that the Iranians are living up to the deal and the inspections are working.
Okay, let's talk about President Trump. Now, it was candidate Trump at the time of the situation with the U.S. naval vessel who was tweeting really inflammatory things. How did that go over in Iran? Or was he ignored because he wasn't the president, he was a candidate?
I'm so glad you asked this because this says something about diplomacy. One of the first things Zarif told Kerry,
Iranian foreign minister
told Kerry, was, you guys made a mistake. We recognize it's a mistake. Don't make any threats. We want to release the soldiers. But if you start making threats, I'm going to have problems on this side. And the cooler heads are not going to prevail. And hot heads in Iran are going to essentially take over this issue. So this was emphasized. Kerry took it to heart. Even the Pentagon at the time, you can go back and check the records, were making statements saying we're having a good conversation with the Iranians. Everything is being handled professionally. They did not inflame the situation. The political class and candidates, etc., they did. They were calling it hostage taking and everything else. Pentagon quickly admitted the American sailors were actually in Iranian waters. They didn't dispute that. Had Obama used the language that many of the Republican candidates at the time, including Trump, were using, most likely those 10 sailors would be wholesale names in every American household because they would still be imprisoned in Iran. Tact, as much as trust, is mm-hmm. very much key in international relations.
One country we didn't talk about of all the countries involved in the negotiation, but this country wasn't involved in the negotiations, and that's Israel.
Yeah.
What role did Israel play in the theater of all of this?
So the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, essentially declared himself the biggest opponent of this deal, and he did everything he could to kill it. Everything from leaking information that the United States had given to him in confidence about the negotiations. He ensured that it was leaked in order to sabotage the talks. He went to Congress, as you may recall, did mm-hmm. something rather unprecedented, a foreign leader coming to Congress to speak against the President of the United States.
And that was at the invitation of the then Speaker of the House.
The Republican Speaker of the House, which, you know, really divided the issue. But what is kind of ironic in all of this is that so much of what he did ended up, in a way, actually helping the agreement inadvertently. By turning this into a Republican and Democratic issue, he actually had a very tough time getting Democrats to vote against the deal. Because voting against the deal would not be a vote against the deal, would be a vote against your American Democratic president in favor of a foreign leader. Moreover, by pushing so hard and making this an existential issue, and at the same time adopting a completely uncompromising position, his aim was to eliminate the status quo option, so that the United States would not be able to just contain the Iranian program and kick the can down the road. He was trying to force the United States to take action, and the action that he wanted was for the United States to take military action. What he didn't calculate was that precisely because the president didn't believe that military action would work, eliminating the middle ground ensured that Obama would pursue diplomatic action. And there's one very funny thing that Netanyahu actually could have done, that he never did, that would probably have ensured, at least according to what Zarif told me, ensured that the negotiations would have been dead. What he could have done, instead of saying that this deal paves the way for an Iranian bomb, he could have just gone out and said, this is a fantastic deal. Israel loves this deal. This is Iran's defeat and capitulation. That would have created massive problems for the Iranians. The Iranians had no problem with Netanyahu saying that this is a horrible deal for the West and a great deal for Iran. It actually helped shut up the Iranian hardliners. But if he had gone out there and hugged the deal, it would have created massive problems for the Iranians, and most likely they would have walked out.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, talking with Trita Parsi about his new book on the Iran nuclear deal. Okay, we've mentioned his name several times. Now we got to talk about him, President Trump. How are relations with Iran now under President Trump?
In 6 months, all the progress that had been made in building some degree of confidence and some degree of working relationship is more or less gone. Tillerson, who's the Secretary of State, has been in power now for 7 or so months and has not yet picked up the phone to call the Iranian foreign minister. He had the opportunity of being able to build off of what Kerry had already established and worked so hard to put into place. And more importantly is that right now, President Trump has, in a rather unusual way, declared and telegraphed that he is going to kill this deal, despite the fact that the Iranians are living up to their agreement, according to the IAEA, according to the U.S. intelligence services. He's just made it clear that he's going to find a way to either claim that they are in violation or force them into violation or just fabricate the evidence. In interviews that he's given with Wall Street Journal, etc., he's made that quite clear. And it's very dangerous because look at what we have right now with North Korea. Is that what we want to have with Iran? To have two major crises of this kind? This is a functioning deal. It would be a huge mistake.
You brought up North Korea, and it makes me wonder if, you know, is North Korea proving to be the genuine nuclear threat that some, if not most, Americans have claimed Iran to be?
Well, North Korea has 60 nuclear weapons, and apparently, based on the latest tests, they have now managed to make sure that they have a miniaturized nuclear weapon that they could put on a missile that would be able to reach parts of the United States. Iran has no nuclear weapons. Iran, as a result of this deal, doesn't even have more than 400 kilos of low-enriched uranium at any point. The minute they have more, they have to ship it out. You need 1,500 or actually 1,200 to actually build a bomb. All paths for Iran to be able to build a bomb have been closed as a result of this deal. If we keep it, if we nurture it, if we build on it, we can ensure that Iran, even after parts of this deal expire, still never gets a nuclear weapon.
How do we know that North Korea has 16? That's a very specific... 60. That's a very specific number.
That's the assessment of the U.S. intelligence services. And they've tested them. They've had plenty of difficulties in many of these cases, but they have nuclear weapons, which Iran does not. They have missiles that can carry nuclear weapons, which Iran does not. And the difference is, with Iran, we have a deal. With North Korea, we don't.
You were saying before, the president, President Trump, has said many times he wants to kill this deal. He wants to kill the Iran nuclear deal. And yet, just recently, the administration recertified that Iran is living up to the deal. And this recertification is something that has to happen every 6 months, every 60 days?
There's several different kinds of recertification, but every 90 days he has to certify it to Congress.
Right.
And he didn't want to. And he had...
It was a big fight.
Apparently, according to some people describing it, he had a tantrum in the Oval Office because he was so upset that Tillerson and others had not given him the option of being able to say that Iran is not living up to the deal. And the problem that Tillerson and them have in producing that package is because Iran is living up to the deal, and he was so upset about that. So he's really signaled and clarified that by October, when the next 90-day deadline comes, he's not going to do it. And this is tremendously worrisome.
So if Tillerson is saying they're living up to the deal, recertify the deal, without having even spoken to his counterpart in Iran, do you think now he'll pick up the phone and call Zarif and say, okay, in October, like, this thing's going down, let's talk, let's do something? I mean, we saw under Secretaries of State Clinton and Kerry that American foreign policy can proceed without the handholding of the president, primarily because those two leaders were presumed to be talking on behalf of the president of the United States. And now we have Secretary Tillerson, who hasn't picked up the phone, seems to be on a very short leash when it comes to the president and the Oval Office, but also is working in a department that is basically empty. Like, there's no one around. Does he even have policy advisors to help him formulate his point of view on anything around the world, but specifically when it comes to Iran, that region, and specifically this deal?
Unfortunately, I don't think we've ever been in a situation in which the U.S. government is as dysfunctional as it is right now and not following procedure. And you mentioned that, why isn't he picking up? I suspect that he would get fired a minute after he did so, because his instructions are not to pick up the phone and reignite the diplomacy and dialogue with Iran. It's finding a way to kill the deal, to have a larger confrontation with Iran. He would essentially be completely defying orders from the president if he picked up the phone.
So after Trump won the election, the Obama administration worked to insulate some policies from Republican attempts to dismantle them. Was anything done to protect that agreement? I mean, are there, even if the president said, I'm killing the deal, are there things, little tripwires built into the agreement to either prevent that from happening or slowing it down?
There are mechanisms in the deal. So, for instance, one of the things the president apparently wants to do is that he wants to use a mechanism in the deal that allows countries to be able to go to the IAEA, which is the International Atomic Energy Agency, and say, there are suspicions that there are undeclared nuclear activities in some sites that the Iranians have not declared, and we need to ask for access to that. The Iranians, because they have signed the deal and what is called the additional protocol, will have an opportunity to object, but there's a voting body that will essentially ensure that as long as the United States and the EU are on the same page, the Iranians will have to give access. But here's the issue. If the IAEA is granted access two, three times to places, and it turns out that there's absolutely nothing there, and those suspicions were based on false information, what that ultimately does is that it undermines the inspections regime and the credentials and the integrity of the agreement as a whole. Because eventually the Iranians are going to say, no, we're not going to give access anymore because you can't just run around here on false intelligence. So it's actually a major threat to the entire core of the agreement if we go to the IAEA with deliberately bad information and claim we have to see this and this and that side, even though we actually don't have any good intelligence to suggest that there's any problems there. And there are reasons to believe that the Europeans essentially will not say yes to this. They've already seen how Trump has walked out of the Paris Agreement, and they're not going to see him, or at least help him, kill this Iran deal. They view it as an absolutely essential thing to stabilize the Middle East and make sure that there is no further major wars in the region.
Can the deal survive without, let's say President Trump says, I'm out, I'm done. But like we've been discussing, this was a P5+1 negotiation, not a one-on-one negotiation. So can the Iran nuclear deal survive or without U.S. involvement?
There might be a very, very small chance that it could if then the Europeans were to defy new American sanctions and protect their companies. Because for the Iranians to believe that there's still anything in it for them, they need to see sanctions lifted and they need to see international investments and companies coming into Iran. If the U.S. walks out of the deal, it's going to reimpose sanctions. But these are sanctions that the U.S. is imposing on European countries if they go into Iran. The question is, will the Europeans accept that their companies are being legislated by the U.S. Congress and by the U.S. government? Or will they say, this is our companies and this is our own business, and as a result, you have no right to pass laws on us just as much as France cannot pass laws that you and I have to follow while we're sitting here in New York? If the Europeans do that, then potentially there is a chance. But it, at the same time, begs the question, what happens between the United States and Iran? If the United States goes back towards a much more bellicose approach and increases the risk of war, then there's a significant risk that the Iranians will walk out of the deal because they may feel that they need to invest in other things in order to be able to deter the United States. That's why this is such a disaster if we so recklessly, so thoughtlessly go against this deal, which in the case of President Trump himself, apparently seems to be almost mainly at least motivated by the fact that this is Obama's deal and he's against everything that Obama has achieved.
Trita Parsi, founder and president of the National Iranian American Council. Thank you for being here. Been talking about your book, Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy.
Thank you so much for having me.